Welcome to this edition of Retire Well, Retire Happy with your host, Annie Nelson, an Australian look at reinventing yourself for retirement and getting yourself retirement ready. It's always fascinating getting to know what people are getting up to in retirement, how they are supplementing their incomes, pensions, where they have chosen to live, how they are filling their time, what charities they are supporting, and what adventures they are having. Anne will also talk to experts in their fields, including investing, health, estate planning, financial advisors, and seniors' health care.
Welcome to today's show. It's your host, Annie Nelson.
I'm extremely excited and privileged to be talking with a couple, and they are Owen and Kay Pope, founders of Anatof, New Zealand's favourite jam and pickle brand. Owen and Kay retired and ended up in Queensland, Australia. They've decided to go back into a version of their former business, and they are here to share their story. So welcome, Owen and Kay.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
I always start our Reinvent Yourself for Retirement talks by getting a little background on people. Would you like to share where you are from and why did you move to Australia and how long have you been here?
Oh, well, I was born in Invercargill and grew up in the farming and timber milling community called Haldane at the most southerly tip of the South Island. That's where the Makakapa trees grow horizontally as a result of the strong salt-laden westerly winds. My mother's parents shifted to Invercargill from Tasmania about 2 months before Mum was born. So there's always been a relationship with family in Tasmania. My great-great-grandfather, John Taylor Pope, was appointed the first postmaster, station master at Invercargill, and he arrived in 1860, and the second letter he got from the Railways Department was to say that the position would have to be honorary, as the province had gone bust. So he then went to set up post offices for about 20-odd years in the south, and but he had two brothers who were in Queensland, and so he shifted over here to Queensland, North Queensland, in 1882, and set up post offices and telegraph offices at Orbitella and Roma and other places, the last being Irvine Bank, where he's buried.
Right, so how long have you been over here now?
Yeah, well, we've been here for 5 years. I arrived here on my 65th birthday, and I'm coming up to my 70th birthday in February, so it's almost exactly 5 years.
Oh, congratulations. I believe you have invented or reinvented yourself a few times. Please tell us about your background prior to going farming.
Yeah, well, I've sold encyclopedias and insurance. You know, I worked in a bank for a couple of years, and I worked for three different departments in the New Zealand government. I've been part of quite a varied list of startup businesses. Established and started a credit union that's now a bank. I was part of a startup team at TY Point Aluminium Smelter at Bluff. Helped set up and started a tavern, done fruit growing, manufacturing, marketing, joinery, and quite a few other things.
Wow, you've been a busy boy. How did you get started making jam?
Well, we shifted from Invercargill to Nelson in 1981, it was. And after working for the government there for a while, we sort of thought, well, what else are we going to do? And we ended up buying a piece of land in a place just out of Nelson called Upper Moutree. And there was raspberries growing on that property. And at the time, all the growing of raspberries was regulated by the government, by government regulations. And the controls were such that there was a compulsory sale and a compulsory purchase of raspberries by the New Zealand Raspberry Marketing Council through district committees. Being a new grower meant that I didn't get to go on the list of growers that had, they had two different lists that you went on. One you got paid more for than the other. and I was on the second list, and so we ended up not getting paid for our first crop of raspberries that we harvested for 2 years. But what I discovered was that I was able to make jam and sell the jam, process what I was growing and sell the jam, providing I paid the levy to the marketing committee for the according to the weight of raspberries that I'd picked.
So you had to pay them to use your own product by the sound of that.
Yeah, that's right. And years later, it amounted to quite a considerable sum of money, and I never ever got that back either. So.
Is it hard to make a consistent product in jam making?
Yeah, you've got to focus on it. You need to know exactly what you're doing, practice it quite a bit, and make sure it's an exact sort of a process. Most people, I think, when they're making jam, they put the pot on because it's going to take a while. They go away and do some other job, and so it never quite ends up the same every time you're doing it. But what I found was that by being there, giving it my full attention, meant that, yes, if you put exactly the same weight in it, cooked it for exactly the same time with the same amount of heat going into it and everything, you got exactly the same result. So basically, I guess what I'm saying is that if you apply yourself to the task, it can be achieved very successfully, which is what we did with Annabelle.
After you retired, I believe Kay has kept herself busy writing a book. Would you like to share a bit about that with us?
Yes, well, I've enjoyed writing this book for several years, about 10 years that we've been out of the business, and it's just sat with me all that time. It's a personal story of our journey from onto the farm and how we made jam because we couldn't sell our raspberries, and how we started the business and grew the jam business into being a successful supermarket product. And I'm hoping that the story will give other people some ideas on how to start a small business and continue on making it successful. Because once you've won a brand, the success with a brand, it stays with people for a long time.
And I believe the brand is going strong in New Zealand to this day.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's been sold. The corporates came in to invest, and we ended up disagreeing with their values, and we walked away from it in the end. And they took the brand on with another manufacturer, and used the latest technology and cooked it in big vats and everything, rather than by hand like we'd done. And still maintained quality that was as good as anything on the market, I think. But it's just been recently sold to Andros, the biggest jam manufacturer in the world. And as far as I can ascertain from the information that I've gathered from documents that are available, they've probably got around about $22 million for it.
That's amazing. Well, you must be very proud of what you created.
Yeah, it is. It surprises me a little that I'm not really upset that they've got all this money and, you know, I'm on the pension. But it doesn't really concern me, to tell you the truth. It's the joy of what we did and the satisfaction of doing that and taking a product from, you know, start-up right through to be market leader, and then latterly to be sold to the largest manufacturer is quite an achievement. Now, I don't think there's many that have done that.
No, well, it certainly is. I believe you've gone back into making jams and pickles business. Does it take up much of your time?
No, it's not. It doesn't take a lot. You know, I think I could probably just about make jam in my sleep, to tell you the truth. That we spend probably a half day, maybe two half days a week making jam and pickle, and it tends to be we go and sell it in the local markets, which is, you know, our social life, really. We've always had contact with the public, with lots of people. You meet a wide variety of people. You know, you can meet high court judges one year we had three prime ministers come and wish us Merry Christmas and Nelson in the market. And if we'd been there this year, we probably would have met Prince Charles. That and all the local people and everybody, you know, it's and the people who are in the market as well. you've been there for quite some time, it's quite a social sort of a community, really.
Is it high or low cost to get started? How much money would it take to get started in this business?
To do what we did and the way we've done it this time, you know, I think this will be the, if Kay's still writing, I think what we're doing now will just about be the third book. The first one, she's just about finished. There's another one to do in between. But then doing it again, the same as what we did before, is even surprised me at how low cost it is. I'm talking about just a few hundred dollars, really. Mm-hmm. Easily financed, you know, out of a pension or anything like that. It's just a matter of knowing, you know, what to do and how to do it and where to go to get the information. That's about all there is. I think there's a wide range of things you could set up and do, especially if you have the support of your partner, which we did when we first started off with Anatot, or if you're on a pension, you have the support of the pension, and that's, you know, allows you to earn some more income, and you can build that up into a business.
Right. Where is your product available to purchase? Is it only at the markets, or do you have another avenue?
Yes, we sell at the Rotary Night Markets and Cotter's Market on Sunday, and we're actually looking at establishing an indoor market at the Annandale Central Mall. At present, we're there in Shop 6 on Saturdays all day. We're going to be there Christmas Eve, New Year's Eve, and another Wednesday. But we're testing it out. We've got a couple of other people there with us, one who's selling fruit and veggies, and another one who's got women's clothes. So we're just trying this out to see whether it's possible to perhaps set up a mini indoor market within the mall, which would be a nice place to be in the hot summers over here.
Yes, we certainly do have hot summers in North Queensland, that's for sure.
Yeah, I love it. I love it.
Do you think it's easy to start a home-based business? What are the basics to know?
Yeah, I find it's a strange thing. My answer to this is it's so simple that I don't know why everybody's not doing it, to tell you the truth. But there again, you see, I know what to do. And that's really, I think, the whole point. If you don't understand what your goal is and the steps that you need to take to achieve your goal, well, then you don't know where to go and how to start. So it is very simple and very easy to do it, but then you've got to get started. I've tried to get people started, and they just give up. I can see, you know, after a conversation of about 5 minutes, I can see that they're missing one of the vital ingredients that you like, talking about recipes, that you need to have to be successful. So, like, the support from the Townsville Council is outstanding. You know, they're perhaps a little bit more expensive than other councils around, but and they are than the ones in New Zealand. But they obviously have a very strong policy of supporting the establishment of small businesses in the city. It's wonderful, actually. So
go to the council.
Well, I don't know if they can. They'll tell you what you've got to do to be able to, as far as regulations go, and what you need. But you do need somebody else to guide you through.
Okay, like a mentor.
Yeah.
As a business owner, what is the most common questions you get asked, and what would you answer?
How can I make a lot of money is what I'm often asked. Well, you know, my stock answer for that is to that question is get a job in a mint. Unfortunately, in business governance, they have the best return to the shareholder as the highest priority. That needs to be changed, I believe. But because that will always be defeated by a business that has quality as their highest priority and efficiency as a second highest priority, And then profitability is the third highest priority, because our values do govern what we do. And if you prioritise those values in that order, you end up with a good quality product and efficiently that will give you a good profit over a longer period of time, perhaps.
So it sounds like you need a system.
No, it's not a system so much as a governing set of principles.
All right.
So those priorities, those values that I said I have, our behaviour is governed by our values, right? So whenever we make a choice or a decision, that's governed by our values. We often don't really understand what our values are. And if you really want to find out what your values are, you need to look at what you do, because your behaviour is strongly governed by your values. Whereas your speech and what you write and everything else, you can lie through your teeth without any difficulty. But it's almost impossible to behave in a way that is contrary to your values. And so what I'm saying, you need to examine your values and make sure you do have producing a good quality product. It only needs to be marginally better than everybody else. And then when people are making their choices as to what they're going to buy, and they're able to say, well, that one is the best one, so they'll go and buy that, then you have to deal with the fact that it might cost you a little bit more money to produce a high-quality product. So what you have to do then is be efficient in your production of it. So your second quality or governing priority has to be efficiency. Once you've done that and got the efficiency in there, then you can look at choices that help to increase your profitability. If you compromise your quality to increase your profit, you'll quickly go down the gurgler, as a matter of fact, because that doesn't work. You've got to have them in that. If you have them in that order, and if you look at what I studied was what people have done and what worked, and if you look at all the major businesses, they do that and they maintain that. So in your choices, in your relationships, in every decision you make, you've got to have that information firmly in the back of your mind and ensure that when you make a decision or make a choice, you're not compromising a higher priority for a lower one, if you know what I mean.
So all right.
You don't increase your efficiency by decreasing your quality. But you can work the other way around.
Okay, thank you. It sounds very wise advice there. Yeah. What recommendations would you make to someone who wants to start their own home-based business?
Well, if they want to come and visit us in the Annandale Mall and have a chat, that would be great. There's several ideas I've got that would make excellent businesses, and I keep burbling on to people about them, but nobody seems to want to do that. I gain my support and my knowledge from the successful business people that I work with and work for, and I'm only too willing to help anybody who wants to get started. I could probably, it wouldn't take any longer than 5 minutes talking to somebody to tell them whether I think they would be successful or not.
I see. Oh, well, that's good to know.
Yeah.
What do you think holds people back from starting a business and achieving their goals?
Right, well, part of it is who we are and what we do. As I said before, and I think a lot of that's genetics. When I did my family history and looked at that, I find that for hundreds of years, as a matter of fact, it's almost 1,000 years I've gone back, that people within the family have done that type of thing. They've been painters and they've been writers. They've been all sorts of things. They've really, it's an issue of starting with a blank canvas and putting something on it. So if you're able to see what a business will look like in its completion, and you understand the small steps that you need to take to get there, then it's all over, actually, apart from the long years of laborious detail and monitoring progress to ensure that it's working. If you don't have the abilities to do that, well, then you're probably better off to get a paper run because you'd enjoy that more, I think.
Okay. So what have you found are the best methods or strategies for keeping oneself motivated and focused?
Well, success, really. You know, if it's not working, walk away. You know, so many people arrived at the supermarket doors, and we've discussed this many times, with the most wonderful product. If only the supermarket would put it on the shelves and everybody was going to make millions of dollars out of it. But it wasn't. It was rubbish. You know, it just, you know, look what Dick Smith did with his jam. He just tried to put a second-rate rubbish on there, thinking that his name would take it. You know, he's got a good, wonderful name, but it didn't do it. So if Dick Smith's name can't get a good jam on the market, well then, you know, Bill Smith down the road isn't going to be able to do it either, I don't think.
Right.
But what you've got to do is make sure, and it's probably one of the key things that I did, was we discovered with our raspberry jam that we made in Upper Moutrie and Nelson that people came back and bought it. And I said to Kay, we'll have this one for ourselves, because we knew that there was a product that people liked, and they would drive 30 miles waiting at the gate for us to come into the market, follow us around to where we parked the car, because we're in a different park every day, every week, and then buy the jam and go home again. So I thought, well, there's something going down here. So I said, okay, right, we'll have this one for ourselves, and we did. We didn't even discuss it in the market, just in case somebody overheard us and did it. But we were very secure. Now, I wouldn't bother doing that. Now I'll tell everybody about it, because there's so many other things that you have to put together to make it work. It's not just, you know, quite that easy, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, that's what you've got to find, is something that people want, and then you do it to everybody.
Right. Okay. So how have you expanded your business now that you've gone back into your jam making and pickles?
Right. We did it the same way as what we started the first time, only this time we have an understanding of the process that we're going through. Before, we didn't know what was going to happen from week to week, and it was a tremendous walk of faith to believe that we're still going to be here next week or next month or next year doing the same thing. Now I'm more certain about that, because I've done it once and I could see that it was that the system worked, and well, the processes that we used worked, and so we started to use the same methods as what we did 25 years ago when we started Anatop. And you know what? The same thing is happening again as what happened with Anatop, only it's happening much faster this time. So the principles which we adhere to, which is the by the book, if you like, it's the principles of marketing that that we adhere to very, very strictly, and they work. And you know, my one of my cousins in New Zealand, or he's about a second cousin, I think, is Jeff. He was the government gave us $100,000 when we started exporting to Australia, and Jeff was in charge of the trading industry at that time, and he came around to see me, and he was jumping up and down on the edge of the couch, so excited about the business. And Kay said, well, you know, it's a little bit sort of different and, you know, not in according to the book. And Jeff said, no, it's exactly according to the book. It's according to the marketing principles that you would see people like Coca-Cola and those large organisations adhere to.
I see. Okay. What is your top three tips for our listeners that they might be able to achieve greater levels of success?
I think that the first thing is that you need to have something that other people want, or you need to have the ability to see what other people want, and then you test it out. And you say, well, I think this is what people want. So you present it to the people and you see if they want it. Like with us, it was raspberry jam for a start. So we made raspberry jam, we put it out there, and we waited to see if people bought it and they tried it and tasted it, and to see if they come back and do it again, look at their behaviour rather than what they said their behaviour was going to be. And so, yeah, that worked for us. We said, well, okay, that one works. We'll try other recipes with our jam and stuff like that, or pickles. And people didn't come back and buy them. So we thought, well, that one doesn't work, so we tossed it out straight away. So you need to find out what people want. And then once you find that out, you then can see if you can test it, mm-hmm. what you think. When you find out for sure that they want it, well, then you have to get yourself in a position to be able to produce it and market it to the people, make it available for people. And then as the demand increases, well, then you can increase your production or your number of people you've got doing it. The same principles apply. It doesn't matter what you're doing, whether you're, making products or providing a service. If you make a product or provide a service that the customer identifies as being the best there is around for a reasonable price, and they will pay a little bit more. You don't go charging an enormous price saying, well, this is a wonderful thing, I'll charge you 10 times as much as anybody else. That's just ripping people off. But if you're able to do that, well, then there's a good chance that you'll make a good living out of it. And that's the other thing. All you want to do is to make a living. That's all we want to do, is make enough money so that we can live comfortably and pay our bills and get ourselves into a wooden box when we get there.
Right. Sounds all very logical. What are some benefits or other benefits of being the owner of a home-based business?
Well, it keeps you active, especially into retirement. We often have that discussion, what else would we be doing? Because you get a bit tired sometimes. But when you do get tired, of course, you can always go and lay down and have a nap for a while, which a lot of retired people do anyway. So that's, you can work when you want to work, really. And you've got a greater interest in things and involvement, and others get involved with you at home and all that sort of thing. There's no waste of time having to go long distances to go to work or you have a different life. You can, I've always worked from home. For the last 30 years I've worked from home. It becomes part of your life.
All right. And since you've retired and gone back to work, I suppose your life, do you think it's changed for you, or you're just doing things on a smaller scale?
Well, life has changed. We were in a pretty bad place in New Zealand. We had, having gone through what we went through with Thanatot after we walked away from it, and we set out to sell our farms and everything, we ended up with nothing. And we lived in some pretty rugged places. At one stage we had a tent set up inside an old building, and our health wasn't very good. At one stage I hardly had the strength to walk, because my hemoglobin level was down to 64. And, at 40, you're out of here. So, and normally it's up to about 150. So when I came to Australia, I went to my doctor, and he gave me a blood test. And next day he rang Kay and said, get Owen into the A&E in Townsville Hospital. And I got three pints of good Aussie blood pumped into me. And the next day, my hemoglobin was up to about 84, and I was, I was fair bouncing up and down the passage in the hospital. And I was inspired by the huge signs that were promoting the employment of seniors that posted on the notice boards. I started to feel wanted and valued, which is something that I hadn't done with all the discussions that were going on in New Zealand about the benefits of euthanasia and all that sort of thing. It really hits you, It's like, why don't you take a pill and get out of here? But the attitude in Australia is so much different. And so when we decided to stay, and we went to Centrelink, and they explained this pension system, and a New Zealand pension isn't means tested. But once we're here permanently in Australia, it's administered through Centrelink, and it becomes means tested. And basically we get treated the same as what Australians do. We get the same same pensions paid through the Centrelink from comes from New Zealand as what Australians get. So, you know, that's great, and within that system, there's encouragement to get into being self-supporting, which is where we'd like to go. We've got a big jump. The next step, of course, is to increase our sales and increase our production, if we can do that, to become self-supporting in that. And that may include employing some people to be able to do the work, because as we get older, we won't be able to do everything ourselves. Mm. And so it has just made an enormous difference. It's given me a new lease of life. And I don't know whether Kay always complains about having to keep up with me, but I think she's got a fair bit of energy as well.
Yeah, I'm sure you both have, and thank you very much for sharing that. That was very personal, and I appreciate the level that you have been sharing with us. So what is the most satisfying part of your career now?
Oh, right. The most satisfying part is being able to produce jam the way we do, and to see people come and buy the product and enjoy it. And, you know, there's so much discussion about diets and everything now that it's still a natural product to produce. It's only got fruit and sugar in it. And sugar's only a carbohydrate, the same as any other carbohydrate. So it's not, the people are trying to demonize it now as they did demonize fat, which is not a good idea, I don't think, because if you want to lose weight, you just eat less. So that's easy enough to do, but the most satisfying thing for me is to see people coming back and enjoying the product, and it really motivates me to make sure when I'm making the jam pot by pot, because I make it in small pots, and 12 or 14 pots at a time, and to make a good quality of it so that they can enjoy it. You know, that's
Okay. Just to finish off now, we've been chatting away for quite some time now. I know you've got some other interests, so would you like to just briefly tell us about your other great passion in life?
Yeah. Well, there's a couple, really. One of the things that I think probably had a great influence on me was Jesus Christ's understanding of human nature. He knew that if he did what he did, then he would end up the way he ended up. So I think that human nature is pretty predictable, and we're seeing that ourselves now from on the international scene. He understood that, I believe, and he knew that if he behaved in the way he behaved, he'd end up being put on a cross. So that's one of the that understanding really grabs me. And the other thing is that family, I think, is important. I've been doing my family tree now for many, many years. I've got about 8,000 people on my website, and I do have a desire to build relationship between them, and it's not easy because we had family working in the business, in the Anatop business, all the way through. But as everybody knows, the neighbours' kids don't act quite as badly as what your own do when you're trying to tell them what to do. So the same thing happens within family. You tend to have a greater demonstration of emotions when you're dealing with family. So that makes it more difficult to work with them within a business. But it also, you have the same sort of thing happening, you know, with within a family tree or doing anything else like that. But I believe the reason for that is because the everybody understands, or maybe they don't understand, but they may have a bit of an inkling, that there is actually an unbreakable connection with DNA. You know, we are structured the same, we're put together the same within families, and we have the same sort of behaviours and values and everything that we adhere to. So we usually come back together. We'll have our disagreements, but you nearly always end up feeling comfortable talking to family, don't you?
Yes, families are our passion, and we all want them to do well, I suppose, in life.
Yeah, we probably are a little bit too zealous in our attempts to get them to do well. You know, if we were able to be more supportive and say, well, you know, you do it like this, you do much better, you know. And often we try and tell your kids to do that, and they say, no, I want to do it like this. So,
And your family tree, I believe that's been a big lifetime project. Just to finish off then, how do you spend much time on it now? I believe you have invested a lot of time and effort into your family tree.
Yeah, we did. I years ago when I started it, was when the internet first started up, I got a guy to build me a website, www.owenpope.com, and started to put designed it myself and everything else. Well, he built it. He was the engineer that did it for me. And that's still there. It's still serving me well. I've got about 8,000 people on it. And they're all relatives. And go back for 1,000 years in one branch of it. And back to about 1600s with the popes. And so it's and I've been all around the world meeting up with them. We went back to the UK, where most of our ancestors are from, and met our third, fourth, fifth, sixth, and seventh cousins and stayed with them, and had some amazing discoveries. You know, when we grew up, we were told in our generation of baby boomers that, and I'm the first of the baby boomers, I was born 9 months and 4 days before Germany signed the surrender. Oh, sorry, 9 months and 4 days after Germany signed the surrender, I was born. But we were told that everybody's born equal, and it's your environment that molds you and your teaching and your learning and your study. But when I went out and started looking at the family, and I found time and time and time again that family who had no connection whatsoever with each other for several generations, four and five and six generations, had the same values, behaved in the same way, talked about the same things, laughed at the same jokes, and even had the same sounding voice and all those sorts of things, I started to realise that genetics have a far greater influence on who we are and what we do than what we were taught as younger people.
Right. Well, it's been great chatting with you. I can see clearly that once you get started on something, that you certainly do a thorough job of it. Thank you very much to both Owen and Kay. It's always a pleasure spending time. I know my listeners will want to know more, so how could they find more about you or your book or your hobby? Are you able to, is the website the best place to make contact with you?
Yeah, well, Kay's not too far away from getting her book published. She's just doing the last review of it now, and we've been talking to the publishers, and it'll be available on
Amazon.
And so just keep a lookout for that.
Is it be an e-book or a printed book?
It'll be both, I think. It'll be available in print and an e-book as well.
Okay.
Those things we have to finalise yet with the publishers.
Okay.
But I think we'll do both. We'll have them available for sale in Townsville here when we get them printed.
And your website again?
And the website again is www.owenpope.com. Now, if you click on Pope Jams, you'll come through to the Facebook page, and you can contact me through there. So if you want to know more, or you can just come and visit us at either the Cotter's Market on the Sunday morning. We're right beside the big screen, beside the stage where the music is, and or else come and see us on Saturdays at the Annandale Central Mall.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to the podcast show of Retire Well, Retire Happy with your host, Annie Nelson. For more information on the show's guests and being retirement ready, pop on over to my website, www.annnelson.com.au, on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Until next time, be happy, stay healthy, and help somebody.